Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the weekly podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager for South and Central Asia here in Washington, D.C. Border disputes, tensions around enclaves and exclaves, regional and ethnic grievances, there are numerous flashpoints in Central Asia. But in long term, water is perhaps the mother of all problems. While deadlock remains, there has been also some efforts to resolve these issues. As we just marked the World Water Day, we thought, let's look into this from a fresh perspective as to how the issue is evolving, the deadlocks, and potential future scenarios. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Helena Fraser, UN's resident coordinator in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, Soumya Balasubramania, senior researcher at the International Water Management Institute, Dr. Kawa Medeni, Imperial College professor and also ex-VP of UN Environmental Assembly Bureau, Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi. Welcome on board, colleagues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. So who to start with? What's that we are talking about here when we say Central Asia's water challenges? Perhaps we can start with you, Soumya. Obviously, it's been described in way serious terms, but let me start this mildly. So what is that we are currently facing when it comes to the water in Central Asia?
I think the problem is in some ways echoes some of the larger trends that we are seeing globally, where you have increasing populations, changing preferences, changing dietary requirements, increases in demands for energy. And when all of that comes together, water is essentially a very basic input that pretty much is involved in the production of food and the production of energy. And that automatically puts pressure on the resource, especially in an environment which is already semi-arid. Climate change makes that a trickier problem to manage. So in a sense, it's almost a two-part problem. Mm. There might be limited physical resources, and then with the increases in populations and the changing preferences, how do we, in a sense, manage those limited resources in order to benefit as many people as possible? In a very broad sense, that's sort of how at least I think about the problem of scarcity and the water crisis. Mm-hmm. There's also a transboundary component to this, of course, because there are shared resources between these different countries, shared water basins. So part of the problem there becomes how do you share the water? How do you manage the water? Countries have their individual requirements, their individual needs, and yet cooperation and coordination might be needed. What are the avenues to make that happen? Those are some of the, in a sense, the broad challenges, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Let's look into this from a very, very local perspective, Helena. So when you think of water in Central Asia, what are some of the things that comes to your mind in terms of challenges?
Well, sustainable water resource management in Uzbekistan, which is where I'm based, really faces two key challenges. First of all, as you know, there are basically two rivers that supply 90% of Central Asia's river water. Right. And for Uzbekistan, in fact, 80% of its water resources in total come from neighboring countries. And secondly, combined with inherited Soviet-era water management practices and the legacy of the monoculture agriculture system, there are significant water shortages, which combined with climate change, exacerbated indeed by these water shortages and the impact of the Aral Sea tragedy, which has affected the microclimate and exacerbated climate change locally, we are anticipating that the pressure on water will lead to increased challenges, both from irrigation, but also access to clean drinking water for rural populations in particular. And of course, we're celebrating today, or late celebration of World Water Day from last week. And, you know, the access to clean, safe drinking water is, in fact, a right. And so the UN is working at it both from the local level to support tackling these two challenges from an Uzbek angle, supporting the government of Uzbekistan, supporting local communities, supporting local authorities, but then also tackling it from the regional level through the UN Center for Preventive Diplomacy and a platform for facilitated dialogue on addressing the sub-regional challenge that the countries of Central Asia face?
Yeah. You know, there are a lot to talk about in terms of what kind of solutions that we are working on. But before that, just to have a precise description of the challenge that we are talking about in Central Asia, Kaveh and Bruce, I was also interested in your points. I mean, this situation is being described in a number of ways, like a water crisis, impending crisis, and all these really heavy words. The way you see it, please describe what is that we are talking about. You know, Kaveh, you have a certain global perspective to that too. That's also useful very much for us in this discussion. So let's start with you, Bruce, then Kaveh.
You know, obviously the water is pretty much all in the east for the most part. Now, the population of Central Asia a little more than 100 years ago was probably about 8 million, and now it's over 70 million. Mm-hmm. You know, even more than 100 years ago, water would have been a precious resource. You can imagine now that, you know, with the population almost 10 times what it was, you know, a century ago, there's a heavy burden placed on the water supplies that are in the region. You know, past that, I would also mention that one of the things that they have not, or maybe they're getting a little bit better at it now, but waste comes in this. We know that they build a series of canals. There's a lot of artificial waterways that were dug and or built during the Soviet era. And I've traveled all around Central Asia, and never ceases to amaze me how you can go by some of these, especially these kind of canals they built that are elevated. They're up on poles, and it goes along the top couple meters over the ground. Inevitably, there's places where there's cracks, or it's just come apart and water just spills out, especially in Turkmenistan. I can remember seeing one part of one of these structures that was had chipped away, and a huge amount of water was just spilling out into the desert. You know, and for a place that really needs like every drop of water it practically can get, the amount of waste that comes from that is horrible. Now, past that, there's a problem of, you know, we've already heard about the problem of drinking water. You know, even in a place like Hojand, which is fairly far up on the Sirdarya River, if you sit down by the riverside there and look, you would never want to drink that water. You know, I know it gets an additional source once the Narin River joins it later on in Uzbekistan. But I mean, that early on, and this is the Sirdarya River winds its way all the way to the Aral Sea, you know, but that early on in its flow, it's already polluted, in bad shape. And so you can imagine there's places where it flows through in southern Kazakhstan, where even years ago they were saying it was unfit, you know, even for agriculture, it was so bad.
Okay, let's see. Kaveh, what's your take on this?
What we are seeing in Central Asia is similar to what we have seen in other parts of the world during their development phase. You have it doesn't matter how slow or, like, you know, is your population growth. So you have a population growth on one side. That means increased demand for food, energy, even jobs in the agricultural sector, and that means more pressure on water resources. Countries become more aware of the importance of water. They get interested in building infrastructure, minimizing outflows, and, you know, that has effect on transboundary surface water resources. Countries start tapping groundwater after you know, going for surface water, so groundwater resources become more and more limited. Then you face water quality issues and other things. Then building infrastructure, which in the development phase all countries and decision makers are very interested in, comes with some consequences, unintended consequences that we have seen in other parts of the world. You know, all sorts of things, that problems that would be new. And the other side, we have the issue of climate change. We're talking about how it impacts the timing of flow, the magnitude of flow, floods and droughts, and again, extra pressure. Now, the other issue that we have in these regions is that social economy and political economy becomes dependent on water, because you try to create jobs. There are certain people who work in this sector, and then fluctuations in water availability means issues for them. So it has implications for their jobs, employment, and so on. So with loss of employment, there would be migrations, and then a lot of, like, you know, chaotic events. Now, crisis is a word that we have been using for a long, long time, and I think it has lost its value, because crisis is, by definition, is an extreme situation which brings everyone together, and you know, everyone wants to respond, people, countries get united, but we don't see that.
So does this mean that it's not a crisis, or people are not realizing that it's a crisis?
We don't want to get into philosophical discussions over the term crisis, but I think overuse of the term crisis has resulted in the loss of sensitivity, so the decision maker, society, are not sensitive to this term anymore because they keep hearing it and they want to see, you know, the world ending, and this doesn't happen. So because we always figure out a way to push things forward. But then I think what we are not pointing out is what is the real problem? So in the development phase, in era of what we call a hydraulic mission, where countries are so ambitious about increasing their capacity of taking water out of the nature in any way possible, country decision makers are after increasing water supply. Normally, we don't pay attention to the demand side, and our demand keeps going up. Our consumption is wasteful. We go for producing wrong crops, non-strategic crops, and then it becomes really hard to reduce consumption at some point.
Soumya, the level of this issue, this situation, let me refrain calling this crisis. I think earlier Helen also hinted that some of them, obviously, it's a Soviet legacy, but it also has been 25 years since Soviet Union collapsed. So the type of challenge that we are talking about today, how it has evolved since the independence of Central Asia, are we seeing more challenges? Decrease in challenge, increase in challenge, what is that?
I think one of the big things that's happened, going back to, again, water, the largest consumptive use of water in the world is in agriculture. About 80% of all consumptive use of water globally is in agriculture, and in that sense, Central Asia is not any different either. Let's take the example of Tajikistan, where a country that I've spent a lot of time in.
Right.
One of the big things that's happened in Tajikistan is because of larger macroeconomic forces, there has been a rapid feminization of agriculture. Now, if you look at, it is the case that after the Soviet Union collapsed, there was a collapse of irrigation management, particularly in Tajikistan. And a lot of capacity was built in through international efforts and government efforts that were coordinated. But a lot of that capacity was instilled in sort of the hands of males, the managers of farms, who are typically male because they're the guys whose names are on the titles of the farm. Now, male migration is so high in Tajikistan, and at the moment it is estimated that something like 55% of the agricultural workforce is female. And in work that we have done, certainly, which covers about 80 sub-districts of southern Tajikistan, we have found that about 35% of farms are actually run by women. Now, what's happening is, in trying to improve the management of water, a lot of that capacity was put into the hands of men who have left. And when farms are taken over by other men, we find that, you know, those farms continue to, for example, sign a contract with their water user associations, or those farms continue to pay their irrigation fees, which is really important in a collective system. But female-managed farms are less likely to do that, mostly because the information that they need to do these things has not been passed on to them by their male relatives who have left. So the nature of the problem is changing in agriculture, where if we want to improve irrigation management, for example, even further, we're going to have to learn how to work with women. And that is quite a departure from sort of that legacy of the Soviet era.
Helena, what's your take on this? I mean, Soumya brought us a very interesting point, like in terms of contributing factors into this continued challenge. So from your perspective, what are some of the major contributing factors into this? I mean, there are structural issues. There are some local and regional politics involved with this.
Obviously, when I said it's a Soviet legacy, it's not just the irrigation system. It's also the outsourcing of cotton production to Central Asian, specific Central Asian countries. And the drain on water resources for the growing of cotton has obviously been specifically challenging for Uzbekistan and for Turkmenistan. What we are concerned about from our perspective is, even as the government shifts away from cotton to diversify its agricultural base, both recognizing the economic rationale for doing so, but also the human rationale for doing so, nevertheless, this isn't going to be, you know, moving fast enough to tackle the water stress that the country faces. And just to put some figures up there, we estimate that over 30% of water used for irrigation is wasted due to the irrigation infrastructure, maybe as high as 50%. And because of the overemphasis on irrigation and poor irrigation practices, unfortunately, 73% of available land is considered to be poor quality because of salinity due to these poor irrigation practices. So really, how you tackle it has to be both at the systems level, And I think the World Bank has been playing a big role in supporting Uzbekistan's shift away from the monoculture and from the low value chain cotton production, which is absolutely essential for water security, but also, you know, from where we're sitting from a human rights perspective, as you know very well. But it's also critical to tackle the sustainable issue of water management and sound water management and introduce water, an incentive structure for rational water use and water conservation. And this is something where I think across the Central Asian countries, there've been varying levels of success in introducing an effective pricing structure and systems. Now, here in Uzbekistan, we've done a lot of work to really build capacity at the very local level, at the community level, to engage communities in technologies for better irrigation. The government recently introduced a policy on drip irrigation to really try to increase the effectiveness of the use of water for agriculture. But obviously it goes deeper than that, and there has to be a whole culture shift for water and energy conservation and efficiency, which is, I guess, a long-term perspective.
Which we definitely like to discuss a little bit later. But before that, Bruce, we heard the situation in terms of contributing factors from Tajikistan and from Uzbekistan. So what is that we are looking at in Kyrgyzstan or in Kazakhstan? We are refraining to describe this as a crisis, but again, people who are the residents of areas surrounding RLC, for them it's a crisis already. But in terms of contributing factor, what is that you witness in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan?
Well, the two countries are in very different situations. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it. I mean, Kyrgyzstan is a mountainous country, and they have a lot of, there is a lot of water there. It's not always where it needs to be. That's true. You know, again, the Kyrgyz would tell you that they're more than happy to be part of regional solutions to this, but that they don't have the money to support a lot of the key, making sure that they maintain the river so it doesn't block up, so it flows clearly. Reservoirs are cleared out, things like that, so they can store this water and release it when it's needed. So their problem is specific to Kyrgyzstan. Kazakhstan, I think you would have to give them a lot of credit for water reclamation, certainly around the Aral Sea area. Helena will know that Uzbekistan is trying to bring back its part of the Aral Sea, and Kazakhstan is also engaged in this process, and they've had a lot of success. They started earlier.
Yeah, we will shortly talk about this. One more question, Kaveh. You know, we are talking about increasing scarcity of water in Central Asia. Now, Afghanistan kind of draws my attention here. I mean, in the past, because of war, I mean, war still is a factor there, but it relatively in parts of Afghanistan where it relies to Amu River, Kunduz River, Panj River, for instance, for water and irrigation, and agriculture is the main source of income for many people there. So since relative stability is coming to that part of the world, they are or will be increasingly relying on water resources. So how much Afghanistan is going to be a factor going forward in terms of stressing the already scarce water resource in Central Asia, or it's not going to be a factor?
Afghanistan is definitely in its development phase that they want to increase the capacity of storing and using water within their boundaries. And of course, this affects their neighbors, and lack of treaties, lack of agreements make the situation tough. It not only affects the rest of the region, but also it has consequences for the country. When we talk about water scarcity, I just wanted to highlight one point, and then just make sure that this is clear for those who are listening to us. You know, water scarcity comes in two forms. One is a physical water scarcity, when your use is much more than your availability. In many parts of Central Asia, we're not there yet. But then we also have the socioeconomic water scarcity, and that relates to lack of economic capacity to develop proper infrastructure for a proper use of water. And some of the places in Central Asia is suffering from this sort of scarcity. And then some arrangements, some financial aid, and these things will be made, and one infrastructure is being built. But because there is no comprehensive long-term plan based on sustainable development goals and long-term view of you know, how to solve the problem, then there would be some effects and some bad effects on all sectors, including the agricultural sector, which is has proved to be very vulnerable in other parts of the world. So I really hope that, you know, Central Asia leaders, engineers, designers pay attention to what has happened in other parts of the world, because we don't have to reproduce every problem that others have already produced and experienced.
Right. Okay. So let's turn the table and look into this from a different angle. I recall Uzbekistan's former president, Islam Karimov's famous remark, perhaps warning, that the water disputes could lead to a war in Central Asia. Obviously, he's no more. And since his death, we have seen some positive changes taking place there. But how far or close we are to a permanent solution, and what are some of the continued deadlocks? We will continue the Majlis talking about this and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today I'm joined by Helena Fraser, UN's resident coordinator in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, Soumya Bala Subramania, senior researcher at the International Water Management Institute, Dr. Kawa Medeni, Imperial College professor and also ex-VP of UN Environmental Assembly Bureau, Biro Spanier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi. I am Mohamed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager for South and Central Asia in Washington, D.C. So yes, it's a serious challenge, serious issue, but how serious is this? And going back to Karimov's famous remarks, perhaps Helena, you can take this question. So how serious is this issue? Are we talking about the war here, potentially?
Well, sitting in Tashkent, it all seems pretty peaceful to me. But let me start by saying, indeed, the pivot towards sub-regional cooperation that took place with the assumption of President Mirziyoyev to the presidency of Uzbekistan has really helped to strengthen the focus of the five countries on how to further develop sub-regional cooperation. And from where we're sitting at the United Nations level, as you know well, the Central Asian governments themselves established over 12 years ago the UN Regional Center for Preventive Diplomacy specifically to support them as a platform for dialogue and for preventive diplomacy, including on transboundary challenges. Now, you know, from our perspective, the work of that center, it's one of the first preventive diplomacy and maybe the only preventive diplomacy special political mission that the UN has, with such a kind of tight and focused mandate that came about because of a consensus among the five countries that they needed that neutral platform, that convening power of the blue flag, as it were, to support their search for mutually acceptable agreements. Now, obviously, we haven't reached a stage where they have finalized an agreement, but certainly starting in late 2016, under this new era of regional cooperation, we are seeing a renewed political will among the decision makers of the five countries to have a structured dialogue around transboundary water management issues and transboundary energy issues. And we think that the current political dynamics in Central Asia are creating opportunities to support the countries to really be successful in the search for those solutions. So I think from where I'm sitting, the chances of success have never been greater.
What makes you believe that?
What makes me believe that? Yeah. Well, I've had the privilege to be sitting in various meetings of the presidents with the president of Uzbekistan. In fact, I think I've been in dinner receptions for all the neighboring country presidents over the last year and a half in their bilateral head of state visits. In these moments of sort of really supportive and positive vibes about how Uzbekistan's opening up towards its neighbors has reset the political dynamics. And this has been stated, I think, by each of the neighboring country presidents in public, but also in these more closed door formats that I'm mentioning. And so coming from a region where the tone is really set from the top, as we know very well, the tone has never been more positive I would say, than it is now in terms of really trying to fix the challenges that have previously existed. We've seen so many examples of renewed will to address border demarcation issues, to address demining issues, to address cross-border trade issues, to address counter-narcotics information sharing. You name it, across the different areas, I would say that the UN engages in Central Asia, we are seeing a positive spirit of a will to address this, starting at the top and going downwards through the different ministries. We saw it in the Turkmenistan head of state meeting as well. And I believe in a couple of weeks here in Tashkent at the Nowruz summit, you know, nothing tells me we won't see further positive dynamics. Again, I'm not privy to how far we are in terms of a concrete tabling of solutions, but certainly we see the dynamic and we see the willingness to discuss transboundary water and energy issues and to look at creative solutions, to listen to expert advice as really providing a fertile environment for reaching constructive solutions.
Okay, let me take a perspective on this from Tajikistan and from Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan. So first, Somia Helena is talking about some renewed interest, some genuine positivity about resolving this deadlock, this tension there in Central Asia. So how it looks like from Tajikistan, and then Bruce, how it looks like from Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan?
I think there is certainly an understanding that this is a shared resource and it needs to be managed judiciously in everybody's interests. One of the big things that, of course, happened in Tajikistan last year was the high-level panel on water was organized and hosted by the government of Tajikistan, which was a major step, which brought together not only the five stans, but also Afghanistan and certainly other countries that face similar problems. The nature of those debates were, I would say, very frank, very open, you know, issues around water management, openly and freely discussed. Issues such as, you know, thinking about water quality, thinking about economic instruments, thinking about IWRM, engineering-based solutions, were talked about. But more importantly, what was very interesting in that larger discussion was the understanding that you really couldn't look at water without thinking about how it fits in into the other economic goals. One of the big challenges that comes to sort of solving issues around water is that there's a tendency to sometimes look at it as a sector and sometimes look at it as a resource. But the fact of the matter is that that it's usually an input into something else. Let me give an example about going back, connecting up to Helena's points and all the talks about monocropping. And all of that is true in the sense that it uses a lot of water. It can be very polluting. But it's also the case that, for example, in Tajikistan, it's currency. It's a really important store of value. Right. And it's something that people store and people sell when they need cash. It's something that doesn't deteriorate in quality. You know, in a country that doesn't have cold storage or processing or canning, it becomes very difficult to talk about diversification unless we, you know, get into all of those issues as well. And so, in a sense, a lot of this discussion at the high-level conference was not just around water, but about how what's happening at other sectors, if you will, in the economy, link up to water and, you know, create that conundrum. So in that sense, I would say that it was a very, at least in Dushanbe last year, it was an extremely positive atmosphere for discussion and conversation.
Yeah, another positive development is also that new Uzbek president's willingness to allow Tajikistan to build the dam. So, Bruce, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan.
You know, Kyrgyzstan, as I mentioned earlier, they've always been open to water cooperation. Mm-hmm. I mean, any one of the Kyrgyz presidents has always said that they want to make sure that their neighbors get the amount of water they need. They also want to make sure that Kyrgyzstan gets the use out of the water that it has. And, you know, of course, by that, I mean the construction of hydropower projects in Kyrgyzstan, mm-hmm. which they financially are in no position to do. And I have no idea when they will be able to. But, you know, so the government has its policy and it's always been accommodating to the neighbors and willing to talk. You know, unfortunately, on the local level, when you actually get down to, you know, the areas where people live, it's one of the places that's really been plagued by water disputes. I mean, we've just seen this with along the Tajik-Kyrgyz border, down in these places by Aksai, Kuktash, those kind of places, you know, where water does set off tensions all the time, you know, just trying to move, extend a field over, block off part of a water or a creek or something, a little stream somewhere, is enough to start people throwing rocks at each other. Oh. And even along the Uzbek border, although it's been better now, they've had their they always focus on this mountain that's out there with the television relay station, but actually the real problem around that is a reservoir, which technically seems to be inside Kyrgyzstan, but has Uzbek ownership. And that's really what sparks the problem there all the time, is the Uzbeks want access to that water, unfettered, unhindered access to that water. So there's been a real problem trying to figure out, you know, at the local level, the governments talk about it and seem to resolve it, but then it gets back to, you know, the locals in these regions, and they either haven't been informed or haven't accepted the decisions that their governments have made, and these problems just seem to be recurrent in the area. You know, Kazakhstan has also been fairly receptive to cooperation on water. They're certainly a downstream country. I can't say that they seem to shift. You know, there was a time when Karimov, of course, you know, you mentioned that he made his statement about, you know, water, if downstream countries suffer, it could be reason for war. And when Karimov would visit Kazakhstan, or when him and Nazarbayev would get together in some other setting, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, CIS, something, Nazarbayev would agree that, yeah, it's a problem, it has to be confronted. But then when Nazarbayev would meet with whoever the Kyrgyz leader was at the time, or maybe meet with Rahman, they would agree that, you know, upstream countries have a right to use the water that they want to. So we don't have a real clear policy, at least under the last Kazakh president, as to what Kazakhstan's stance is. Although, you know, again, generally, they're for discussions, regional discussions on water use. And certainly they've been one of the few countries that's actually continued to fund efforts to save the Aral Sea. And I mentioned earlier they'd done work on their part of the Aral Sea. But I mean, really, the fund that Central Asia created years and years ago, that was specifically designated, targeted at saving the Aral Sea, Kazakhstan has been one of the few countries that's really regularly made its full donation to this, even when other countries have backed off this.
Okay, let's take, Kavi, your point in this. I hear from our panels there are some genuine positivity towards this. So if we were to solve this issue, where the solution will come from? In which form, in which way?
It's hard to answer that question, I think. But looking at, you know, history, we have seen that in the last century, the cases of cooperation over water outnumber the cases of conflicts. And we have never had a war in history which is only for water. Yeah. We have never had two countries getting united only for water. But water is always part of a bigger package of cooperation. So this is very important to understand that, you know, cooperation only over water might not be feasible, and we can spend a lot of time negotiating and taking photos and showing good gesture. But we have to find other issues to link with water and then come up with good win-win solution packages that work for the region. If we look at the immediate sectors that come into mind, are, you know, the energy sector, the agricultural sector, which are naturally linked to water. But sometimes you have other sorts of cooperation between countries which would help their water cooperation. In case of Afghanistan, for example, that you mentioned in your previous question, Afghanistan and Iran are negotiating over water in their negotiations over other topics. So water is a topic that they are including in their negotiations. So there is a lot of room for improvement. There is a lot of room for sharing infrastructure, operating infrastructure together, investing in development in the countries in the region. And the benefit would be for all, because we need to understand that environmental problems of ours don't recognize our geographical and political boundaries, and the problems would, you know, stay in the region for generations, and they go across borders. And if we develop that mentality, if the general public develops that mentality, then there are chances for cooperation, and you know, we will see more stuff. Okay. But also threats, common threats, create opportunities for cooperation. If we take climate change seriously, if we take the water problem seriously, if we understand what is happening to the farmers, if we understand what, you know, how empowering farmers matters and how effective it would be, then there would be cooperations. International funds also sometimes help with cooperations, because they create an incentive for cooperation. Sometimes they come with the requirement of cooperation between countries, and that's another, you know, area where we see some hope.
Okay, I think we are somewhat over time, but let's conclude this with final points. You know, I heard some positive developments, positive hopes, some cautious hopes. So what's that, Helena, you would be looking at going forward to determine where we are headed with this problem, with this issue?
Well, thank you very much. I think we would, as I mentioned, really try to continue tackling this challenge on two levels. I completely agree. These challenges know borders. And that's why it's important that the UN, which is relatively well trusted by all the Central Asian states, continues to facilitate the sub-regional dialogue on natural resource management that will be under the Center for Preventive Diplomacy. But it's also important, in my view, that the UN country teams, the operational development agencies, work cross-boundary, cross-border to support, for example, the basin water commissions, the water users associations, and so forth, to build trust. As was mentioned, this can be a flashpoint in local communities. I'm pleased to say that the UN has now just received approval to do that across the Uzbek-Kyrgyz border, to engage with communities for confidence building and support in the new atmosphere. And then I think it's important, finally, to really keep investing in supporting in each of the Central Asian countries the long-term national water strategy that really looks at the period up to 2030, the aspiration enshrined in the Sustainable Development Agenda for sustainable resource management, for effective climate mitigation measures, and of course for clean and safe drinking water for all. And that will require us to continue in investing in the institutional capacity, building capacity for water and energy conservation, and working on the issue of efficiency. We've shown clearly through some pilot projects that UNDP has led in a number of the countries in the region, that working with the Water Users Association, we can reduce loss of water by up to 30 to 35% in terms of improving efficiencies. So there are positive directions to take. There's positive stories to build on. I would agree with the colleagues. This is not a crisis. It's a very serious and long-term and evolving challenge. And I think if we harness the political momentum in the sub-region right now, and also put our collective support and resources to tackling it, that we can make a significant positive impact.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So let me also take Dr. Soumya, your point in this, in the context of this political development that Helena was referring to. So what you would be looking at going forward to determine where are we headed with this challenge?
I agree with all the points that Helena raised. I think one of the key things here is to really build human capacities and capabilities, especially in terms of being able to use better data in order to understand the problem, identify the problem, identify solutions. At the International Water Management Institute, many of our colleagues have worked with government agencies in different Central Asian countries to train them in different types of tools, in being able to use decision support analysis in order to better identify the problem, diagnosis, identification of solutions. I think a lot more can be done, I mean, globally and certainly in the region as a community, in order to better integrate and increase the coordination between building capacity at different levels. So it's not just about building the capacity of an agency that might be in charge of tackling a particular problem, but it's also about building capacity all the way down, at the level of water users, understanding that those demographics and those needs are changing as well. And at the end of the day, I think it's about also keeping an eye on what do we not know, and constantly checking some of the assumptions, because a lot of things that we assume are nuanced, and many of the things that are true also change. And so I think being able to fill those knowledge gaps and invest in capacity would be key, including for cooperation and diplomacy.
Okay. Dr. Kove, also, your point in this moment, I carefully listened to both of our guests so far into my final question. So there are lots of, ifs and wins when we talk about the future. What's that you will be looking, some of the elements to determine where the region is headed with this issue, either positive or negative way?
I think it's not hard to project the future of the region when we look at other countries which have gone through this phase. And in this phase, the perception of development is different. Governments and decision makers and the general public take pride in physical infrastructure, in concrete and steel. Yeah, while in the short run, that would be a boom in economy, construction creates jobs, and there are lots of opportunities. In the long term, we have a lot of impacts on the ecosystem, on water quality, on water losses, on groundwater level drawdown, on salinization of soil and losing productivity and so on. So we see a period of growth and then a lot of problems to come with it. And that would be, I think, unfortunately, the unavoidable future at this point, unless there are major policy reforms and a determination for change. Unfortunately, in the weak economies, the governments don't have the flexibility of diversifying their economy enough to be able to address their problem, environmental and water problems, properly. And that is sad. And then, you know, add to this the climate change spice and the growing population and demand and conflicts and tensions and so on. And it is not really a good picture. While I'm not, like, you know, a fan of scaring out people and telling them that, you know, they're doomed and the future is very dark, I'm a fan of saying, like, you know, enabling, you know, thinking about how to enable the future, how to make sure that we don't end up in this situation. And I think talking about practical solutions, not theoretical solutions, listening and learning from the mistakes of other countries would help us avoid that future. And we already heard a lot of good stories and initiatives and positive thoughts about what can be done in the region, and it is important to take advantage of those opportunities. Mm.
Okay, Bruce, so there are two varying perspectives here. So what is that you are going to look into to determine where we are headed with this going forward?
Well, I mean, one thing has already been accomplished. There's no more threats or criticism. And, you know, that I credit Mirziyoyev and his administration with that. That's gone. That's already very helpful.
Right.
The other one is they have a lot of outside help. A lot of international organizations want to get involved and help them with this. One of the things that I've always found concerning sometimes about Central Asia is when they have a real crisis, they just figure that international organizations will bail them out of it somehow or another. They're happy to turn over the problem to somebody outside the region. So it's going to be real important that they talk about this amongst each other and really work both with in conjunction with international organizations and just amongst themselves to do this. There's going to be less water. 20 years ago, I remember they had a drought and it lasted a few years. Well, you know, the population's increased by then. If the same thing happens again and we know there's already less water, it's going to be more devastating. So I appreciated what Kaveh was talking about, you know, looking forward to these challenges of the future positively and trying to figure out now what they can do to keep from finding themselves in a bad situation soon, you know, sooner or later. Like I said, it's going to happen. There's going to be another drought. So, you know, it's really how much they're going to be able to resolve this amongst themselves and keep a continuing and positive dialogue going.
Okay, terrific. Thank you very much, Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. And big thanks goes to Helena Frasser, UN's resident coordinator in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, Dr. Soumya Balasubramania, senior researcher at the International Water Management Institute, and Dr. Kaveh Medeni, Imperial College professor and ex-VP of UN Environmental Assembly Beirut. Thank you very much, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you.
And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.